listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and Mike Papantonio, America's lawyer and host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringoffireradio.com, and Ring of Fire TV over on Free Speech TV, is on the line with us, Mr. Papantonio.
Tom, good to talk to you.
Great having you with us. I've been watching this Jeb Bush saga unfold, his son coming out and saying, yeah, he's going to run for president. And then he says, oh, boys will be boys. But, you know, he's behaving like a guy running for president. And I don't know if you caught it this morning, but John Huntsman's dad was on Morning Joe, and he said, you know, I want Jeb Bush. And we're hearing this from a lot of party regulars, that Jeb Bush, this is going to be Bush v. Clinton.
I make it a point to rarely watch Morning Joe,
yeah.
But it doesn't surprise me. Look, it's interesting. You know, yesterday Jeb Bush is out talking about Obama handling the Ebola crisis wrong. Now, that's for a reason. He's trying to put himself into a natural stature and say, look, I have the ability to handle these things. But what Jeb Bush fails to say is that President Obama is doing everything that the best scientists and medical experts in the world are telling him to do and how to handle Ebola. Jeb's criticism of Obama as being as incompetent is exactly what you expect these days, really from a GOP Tea Party talking head type. And what's interesting, Tom, is Republicans have worked so hard to keep all the Jeb Bush character defects away from the public eye. The GO plan was to roll Jeb out as this new, improved, intelligent version of George W. They wanted him to look like Daddy. They sure didn't want him to look like Big Brother.
Yeah.
But now we see his anti-science side, and we start seeing his Tea Party side is emerging day by day.
So Jeb Bush was governor. The one consequential event that I know of when he was governor was he ordered Catherine Harris to purge 80,000 African Americans off the voting rolls, which put his brother within stealing distance of an election. Is that accurate? And B, what are some of the things that people need to know about Jeb Bush when he was governor of Florida? You live in that state.
Well, first of all, you're absolutely accurate. He knew exactly what he was doing. He committed fraud. Catherine Harris was part of the team that helped commit fraud. And so the story with Jeb Bush is that nationally they've worked so hard to make him look like he's different, that maybe he's not Ted Cruz or Mike Huckabee or Rick Perry or Rand Paul or et cetera, et cetera. But what's wrong with that picture is that for years the GOP has guarded this secret that old Jeb really is no different than every Tea Party type who ever carried a sidearm or some insane protest sign to a town hall meeting. They've done a very good job masking all that because he says the right things. They forget. The media doesn't even know that he wrote the mission statement along with Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and all Cheney, all the war crazies. He wrote the statement for PNAC. And PNAC, of course, was this organization that got us in the war with Iraq, wanted to get us in the war with Syria and Iran. So it is a misunderstanding that media has perpetuated that this guy is different. Project for a New American Century, if you want to understand how crazy Bush is, little Jeb Bush is, go look at what the Project for a New American Century had to say. Basically, it was about world dominance. It looked like Dr. Strangelove had written the damn thing. It is that we are to invade, attack, and use our military might to again improve our stature in the world. This is a creepy, creepy guy. And unfortunately, the media has been complicit in trying to make it look like he's almost normal. He's been the GOP's kind of secret weapon, but he's as much of a dud as every other candidate who's going to be trying to be elected on the ticket. He's not the ace in the hole for GOP. And hopefully, when he gets out there on a national stage, we'll start seeing it. Listen, you want to know what he's about? He's no different than the rest of them. You know, he's anti-government. He's anti-science. He's pro-big corporation. He's anti-intellectual. He's anti-education. There is no difference from this guy and every other Tea Partier that shows up in Crazyville. But the media has done such a poor job. They've given him such a pass. They don't talk about his involvement in the SNL burn down. What did he have to do with that? He had a lot to do with it. They don't talk about the idea that he didn't improve anything in Florida from the standpoint of how are we doing, you know, how was education doing. He tried to privatize education. He tried to privatize the prison system. What you have, Tom, truly, what you had is Jeb Bush was the beginning of the real neocon effort throughout the country that the other governors embraced, people like Scott Walker and people like Kasich, people like Rick Scott here in Florida. They embraced the very ideas that Jeb Bush launched. And the media has done a terrible job telling the story about how crazy this guy really is. You know why? Because he looks sane. Yeah. He can talk in a complete sentence. He doesn't sound like his big brother. He sounds intelligent. But there's a real edge to that that we have to understand.
I'm guessing that the Republicans are looking at it somewhat like this. Here's a guy who could be our secret weapon. He's actually fairly intelligent. He's smart enough to know what to say for the rubes.
Yes.
Right? He's smart enough to know how to pretend Tea Party and yet at the same time, he was smart enough to suck up to the military industrial complex and the neocon guys, which means that he's going to have billions of dollars behind him. The war guys. And he's married to a Hispanic woman, and that's a huge vote out there that's potentially a swing vote.
It's a very big swing vote in Florida. Look, there's another part of the story that you're talking about here, Tom. The Value Voters Summit tells you a lot about how the real crazies regard Jeb Bush. Now, this is the Jeb Bush problem. He is more of a war hawk. He is more of an establishment GOP war hawk than he is where it comes to actually delivering certain things in the eyes of the Tea Party movement. Even though he comes from there in every sense, they're not happy with him. As a matter of fact, the Value Voters Summit, Ted Cruz, Ben Carson, Mike Huckabee, and an unknown write-in candidate all were higher in numbers than Jeb Bush. As a matter of fact, Hillary Clinton was just right below Jeb Bush where it came to the Value Voters Summit. Now, those are the crazies of the crazies. You understand?
Right.
Those are, and what did they get mad about? They got mad about his immigration stand. They, you know, he wasn't tough enough because his wife told him, by damn, you better not be tough on this issue because you're talking about my friends and my family. The other thing was the Republican Leadership Conference, Tom. He did terrible. Ted Cruz, Ben Carson, Rand Paul, much higher numbers than Jeb Bush.
Right.
So it's this odd position that he's in. I just don't think he's going to be the kind of candidate the GOP thinks he is.
Yeah. Although, you know, I remember when George W. was floating his candidacy in 99, 2000, and there was talk about how his brother Neil helped rob the Silverado savings and loan,
yes,
and this was going to come back and haunt him, and his brother Jeb had done some sketchy stuff as governor of Florida, and that was going to come back and haunt him, and none of it ever haunted him.
Well, you know why? Because the media never did anything with it.
Right.
Look, it's the theme. I know you probably tire me of talking about it, Tom, but corporate media is functionally dead where it comes to that kind of
important. Oh, yeah, and it's not just corporate media. On NPR this morning, I heard Mara Liasson talking about how in the Colorado race, the Republican has disavowed his personhood stuff and now wants to help women by making birth control over the counter. Right.
Yeah.
Anyhow, Mike Papantonio, America's Lawyer, ringoffireradio.com. Thank you, Pap.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back. There's a lot more. Senator Barbara Boxer is going to be with us. Greg Palast, James Risen with the New York Times. Stick around. And welcome back. Mike Papantonio, you're still with us?
I am, Tom.
Cool. So tell me what's going on with the Ring of Fire TV this weekend, this Sunday.
We're going to be talking about stories, hopefully, that mainstream media just doesn't understand. Very talented young lawyer, Chris Pulis, is going to tell us about the corruption at the IRS, where the agency was giving corporations incredible breaks and privileges and then hammering the average American. David Haynes is going to talk about the damage that Bush has caused to the judiciary, specifically the problems coming out of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Linda Lipson, CEO of America's Association for Justice, is going to tell us how her organization's new project is to expose lawsuit hypocrites like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and FedEx, companies that abuse the legal system and try to block your access to justice so they can have complete domination of the courthouse. Howard Nations is going to talk about the Republicans crying that Obama is an imperial president and he's ignored, and they're going to ignore the previous 8 years of the Bush administration and everything that they had done. But we'll talk about the dangers and consequences of right-wing hate talkers like Mike Savage. It's a story, Tom, forgive me, but I just can't let go of it. This is an ugly, disgusting character, and we need to pay attention to how dangerous Michael Savage really is.
Yeah. I or as I call him, Michael Wiener, who performs as Michael Savage.
Yeah, that's it exactly.
Yeah.
So, but what we don't, I'm sorry, go ahead, Tom.
Well, if you don't mind, I had one more question about Jeb Bush, but you know you can.
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead.
Well, I was talking that to me the Michael Savage story is about what he has the propensity to do. There's a great book, it's called, the term is eliminationist. And the eliminationist is the person that takes hate, and they take this language of hate, and they try to talk their neighbors into jumping into the action of hate right there in their community. Michael Savage is the person that empowers them. It's like, the best description is it's like Michael Savage gives them the stick to go around poking everybody in the eye that they disagree with. And so it's dangerous language, and it's the kind of language that in most countries, matter of fact, Michael Savage was not even permitted, I'm trying to think of the country he was not permitted to come into, I think it was the UK, because his language was so offensive.
It violated their hate talk laws.
Exactly. It violated the hate talk laws. But nevertheless, we have him on the air here in the United States. Advertisers pay money. You have radio stations that have him up there like he's just a normal guy talking about normal issues. He panders to the very bottom of the apple cart. And they're the most dangerous, and he inflames them and gives them power to go out and do the ugly things they do.
Yeah. Just 30 seconds left to go. Jeb Bush was governor during the Terry Schiavo thing, wasn't he? Does that help him or hurt him?
I think it doesn't make any difference. By the time he's running, people won't even remember Terry Schiavo, and he made it into a political issue. It tried to prop up, obviously he was there to prop up, rights issues, but I think by the time he runs, it'll almost be a non-issue, Tom. It's an ugly story. It's a story that's worth telling again, but the media won't tell the story.
Amazing stuff. Amazing stuff. Mike Papantonio, America's lawyer and host of Ring of Fire Radio, Ring of Fire TV, right here on Free Speech TV. RingofFireRadio.com is the website. Pap, it is always wonderful having you on the program. Thanks for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking to you. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And I came across a story this morning in a couple of different places that absolutely fascinated me that I want to share a completely different take with you about. Unless we're doing the video. No, we're doing the video, in the next block. Okay, cool. And I just thought this was incredible. Both Alaska and in New York State, people are getting letters that say things like this. And this is the one that came to Tom McKay. He writes about this over at thedailybanter.com. He's a registered Democrat. This was sent out by a Democratic group, the Democratic Party group. And it says, "Dear Thomas, our records indicate that you are registered in New York County. Who you vote for is your secret, but whether or not you vote is public record. Many organizations monitor turnout in your neighborhood and are disappointed by the inconsistent voting of many of your neighbors. We will be reviewing the New York County official voting records after the upcoming election to determine whether you joined your neighbors who voted in 2014. If you do not vote this year, we will be interested to hear why not. Now, Tom McKay says, in other words, do not disappoint us. Many organizations will be monitoring your voting habits like your nosy neighbors and the mafia. Right? He's comparing this to mafia pressure. And in fact, the headline is, I received this menacing letter from the Democratic Party trying to shame me into voting. It's over at thedailybanter.com. But here's the thing. And thanks to Tom McKay for this. He points out the history of this. And it turns out that back a few years back, before the 2006 Michigan gubernatorial primary, three political scientists decided that they were going to check out how can you increase voter turnout? Can you use social pressure? The list of registered voters and who voted and who didn't is public information. You can look up anybody. It's how the Republican Party has built this database that we're going to talk with Greg Pallast about in the second hour of our program, of millions of voters who have similar last names, maybe not same middle names, but they're going to try and purge these voters because they have Hispanic-sounding names or Black-sounding names or even Asian-sounding names. But in any case, what they did is they mailed out a mailer similar to what I just described to you, pointing out to people that this is in 2006 in Michigan, pointing out to people that whether or not they voted was a matter of public record. And that this organization would be, and these were just researchers, that they would be publicizing whether or not people voted. After the primary, the New York Times writes about this back in 2006. After the primary, the academics examined the voter rolls and were startled by the potency of peer pressure as a motivational tool. The mailer was 10 times better at turning non-voters into voters than the typical piece of pre-election mail whose effectiveness had never been measured. 10 times. That's not 100% better. That's 1,000% better. Now, Tom McKay, the Democrat, is offended by this. In Alaska, the same thing is happening. Only it's being driven by the Republicans. This over at Talking Points Memo by Rachel DeOro. Scores of Alaskans have complained about receiving emails and letters to find their voting histories and those of their acquaintances sent by an elusive group calling itself the Alaska State Voter Program. It looks like this group was funded by a guy in Lake Oswego, Oregon, a little town, a very affluent town, a bedroom community of Portland. It used to be just down the road from where I lived. And this fellow, John Bryan, gave $200,000 to this PAC. John Bryan is the founder of the Plano, Texas-based nonprofit Challenge Foundation, writes Rachel DeOro over on Talking Points Memo. And his organization supports charter schools. Basically, they're all about, hey, let's make some money on education. Let's privatize education, charter schools around the country. They sent a letter out to registered Republicans in Alaska, presumably to registered Republicans. Actually, the post on TPM doesn't specify. But it says important taxpayer information enclosed. There was no tax information. And then it basically says you're on the voting rolls and we're keeping track of you. And we're going to publicize whether you voted or not. And the state elections director, Gail Fenumayi, I don't know how to say her name, I'm sorry. My apologies to Gail. She said that at least one voter registration with the state has been canceled because of the messages. She says, we've never seen the state list used in such an invasive manner. People are very upset about it. It is public information, but the way we've seen it used is above and beyond anything we've ever seen before. So both Republicans and Democrats are kind of offended by having it pointed out to them that their vote is a matter of public record, not who they voted for, but whether or not they voted. I think this is great. Right. Somebody called the other day and said, how do we get more Americans to vote? And I was like, well, in Australia, it's like a traffic ticket if you don't vote. And it goes up like really rapidly for every election you miss. And so you get 98% voting turnout. I think that what we should start doing is asking newspapers, or maybe even paying newspapers, to publish a list the day after the elections of everybody who failed to vote. Or just a list of everybody who is eligible, who is registered to vote in the region for which that newspaper publishes. And this is going to be several pages long. It can be small print, but it's alphabetical. So, hey, it's easy to find yourself. And it says, okay, you're registered to vote. Here's the last time you voted. This is public information. It should be in the newspapers. So everybody can see whether people voted or not. And if that's 10 times more effective at getting people to vote, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, this is totally nonpartisan. I'm totally in favor of this. I don't mind my name being in the newspaper, whether or not I voted. It's a matter of public record. If you don't want a matter of public record, change the law. But as a matter of public record, we should be using this. What do you think? 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We may have a mechanism right in front of us, very cheap, relatively cheap, to increase voter turnout. What a cool thing. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And just a quick FYI, and we've done two videos now that Leonardo DiCaprio, Sam Sachs and me and Lila Connors and Matthew Schmidt wrote these things. And both Leonardo DiCaprio and I narrate them, essentially. They're over at greenworldrising.org. And the first one was about methane. The second one was about carbon taxes. And this third one, it just came out today. And it's basically focusing on the possibility of a green world. And it's really a remarkable video, and you can watch it. It's free. It's 9 minutes. The new Leonardo DiCaprio movie is out. You want to see it? Go over to greenworldrising.org. And in the meantime, let me play it for you. Here it is.
The scientific community has spoken. Climate change is happening now and is caused by human activity. Fossil fuels, black oil, coal, and gas have created modern society as we know it. But when burnt into the atmosphere, carbon causes climate change. But it doesn't have to be this way. We have the solutions, and we must move quickly to implement them. Human ingenuity, working alongside Earth's natural systems, is building a new world that is sustainable and self-reliant. By harnessing the elements, the sun, wind, and waters, we can move away from our dependence on fossil fuels, decentralize, and create a sustainable economy that will support our modern civilization long into the future.
To bend the carbon curve and reverse climate change, we need to stop burning fossil fuels. But how do we power this new world? What does the world look like off fossil fuels?
The first thing people need to understand is that we don't need fossil fuels anymore. It's been this terrible myth that has kept us chained to those dirty fuels, that they're a necessary evil, and we just don't need them.
We need to start transitioning rapidly, at least by 2020, to a state of clean and renewable energy for all purposes. That's electricity, transportation, heating and cooling, and industrial processes. And we think clean is wind, water, and solar power. So for electricity, it's wind turbines, solar photovoltaics, which go on rooftops or in power plants, even tidal and wave offshore, even geothermal power, some hydroelectricity. For heating and cooling, we need heat pumps that run on electricity and run in reverse for air conditioning. Also for industry, high temperature processes, we'd use electricity or some hydrogen.
Solar is proven technology. People have been investing in it for decades. Google, Apple, Warren Buffett's invested almost $7 billion in solar projects. So if you do it right, you can create a really solid investment that generates cash flows every month. And Mosaic is working to make it possible for all of us to participate in investing in this exciting and important new asset class that are banking on the sun.
And the reason this would save money in the long run, in terms of electricity, wind, water, solar have zero fuel costs. So once you put up these devices or a wind turbine or solar PV, the fuel cost is zero, and so you stabilize the price over time, whereas fossil fuel prices are going up over time. So if we look at the 10 states in the United States with the highest fraction of electricity from wind in the last 10 years, this price of electricity in those states went up only 3 cents a kilowatt hour. All the other states went up 4 cents a kilowatt hour. So this is evidence that you stabilize prices when you put up renewable energy.
We have the capacity, we have the robustness to step up to big, big crises, to big, big challenges, and deliver not just nation-shifting solutions, but planetary-shifting solutions.
Germany and Denmark, for example, have done a tremendous amount in order to transition both to renewable energy resources, but also to transition the control of those resources from the hands of utilities and the traditional controllers into the people, like cooperatives, farmers, individuals, now providing their own energy.
We are at exactly the same moment that Germany was at. We have over 500 coal plants in this country that are fundamentally non-economic. They can't compete with alternatives like solar and wind. So what is going to happen in the next few years, they're going to have to pick an alternative source of power. We could have exactly that kind of revolution, really exciting, democratizing power activities that are happening at the state and local level.
You know, for 100 years, we've had power systems that have been centralized. The power plant is out in a remote location, and the power travels from there to our homes and businesses. And the idea is basically to spread it out, to generate power closer to where we use it from all the sorts of different sources.
Clean energy is one of the largest wealth creation opportunities of our time. If we can make it possible for people to participate in and benefit from that transition, it's one of the biggest opportunities for broad-based prosperities.
When communities are making decisions for themselves, they're going to pick renewable energy resources because it's not only a source of energy, it's a source of power and control over their energy future, and it's a source of economic development. Communities are doing what are called microgrids, people creating sort of miniaturized versions of the electricity system. They're doing it on college campuses like University of California, San Diego, and they're doing it in places along the Northeast.
In our plans to power the world, we're converting everything. Not only are you going to be powering normal electricity like we do today, but vehicles will be powered by electricity. Even if it's hydrogen, it'll be hydrogen produced from electricity.
So the transportation accounts for about one-third of total carbon emissions in the United States. If we want to get serious about mitigating the effects of climate change from the transportation sector, we really need to talk about cutting our oil use, making our gasoline-powered vehicles and trains, planes, and ships more efficient. The second is promoting and developing electric vehicles. And then the third is also promoting the use of non-food-based biofuels. Electricity is traditionally much cheaper to be used as a fuel compared to gasoline. An electric vehicle driver will save about $13,000 in fuel costs over the lifetime of that vehicle, which is significant savings.
Airplanes are one of the tougher ones, but there are technologies that can get us there too. You turn the algae into a biofuel, and the whole process sucks up more carbon than it uses. So a carbon negative biofuel can be used to power planes until we have technologies that can fly planes with electricity or potentially other things in the future.
Our food system will also be reinvented. Our reliance on big agriculture with pesticides, fertilizers, and herbicides that come with it results in unnecessary greenhouse gas emissions from enormous factory farms.
Between 44 and 57% of current CO2 emissions per year can be directly traced to industrial conventional agricultural practices. As we have 7+ billion people on the planet, as we're dealing with climate extremes, as drought becomes the new normal, what farming system is more resilient? Regenerative organic agriculture is more productive. The organic fields produce 30 to 35% more corn than the conventional fields. Plants that are being farmed organically are more able to respond to the climate extremes that are the new normal. So when people say that we need conventional agriculture to feed the world, look at all the published data showing that we need organic agriculture.
The paradigm shift is possible because of the technology shift, because wind and solar are inherently decentralized resources. And so we have this opportunity made possible by the technology. The issue really is one of control over that energy system and one about market share for the utilities. And frankly, they're reluctant to give up. It was essentially been a 100-year monopoly over both control of the system and control of the economic resources. Unless we have the rules
set up in such a way to allow for broad participation, broad ownership, we may not see that paradigm shift in the control of the energy system.
We need to be making the choice to promote the energy technologies that are going to build a more prosperous future. I think we all know that that's clean energy now. If we can get people literally invested in the clean energy future and participating actively to create it, then we've got a lot better chance to avoid the scary climate problems that we face and to all be a part of this better future. It doesn't get a whole lot bigger than this.
It is now clear that we can power civilization with sustainable sources of energy. This goal is not only achievable, it is also good economic policy. In a few decades, renewable energy can supply 100% of our world's energy needs using existing technologies, and it would create millions of jobs. Given the global threat of accelerated climate change, it is imperative we transition now. To learn more, go to greenworldrising.org.
There you go. So this is the new Leonardo DiCaprio movie. I say that somewhat tongue-in-cheek. It's not a movie. It's a video. It's a documentary. But it's really well done. It's a really good piece. Apropos of that, I have talked a number of times in the past about my theory of why CEOs make so much money. And that being because there's a small universe of people who are sociopaths and understand business. To prove my point, Royal Dutch Shell, now again, oil companies, I mean, how can the oil subsidies, the subsidies that the oil companies get are, yeah, I mean, you paid $500 last year, a little more than $500 in subsidies for fossil fuels and $7 last year in subsidies for solar and wind. You take away those fossil fuel subsidies, fossil fuels are no longer economical in the United States. So who could run a fossil fuel company and keep pushing for those? A sociopath. And Royal Dutch Shell has their head is stepping down, their chairman, and their new chairman is the former head of the Bank of America. Ta-da! Hey, get the banksters who ripped people off, stole their homes, destroyed their lives, you know, caused suicides all over the place, and get one of those bankster guys who can do that and sleep at night and put him in charge of the oil company. That's going to contribute to the possible death of everybody. But, you know, hey, what do you really think, Hart? Anyhow, it's 15 minutes before the hour. We'll pick up your calls, Ed. Stick around. We'll be right back. Oh, Barbara Boxer's going to be with us, too. Senator Barbara Boxer will be here in 5 minutes.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And at TomHartman.com, you can create your own blog. You can post on our message boards. You can, every day at our homepage, you can check the hottest threads. It's a great newly reinvented site. And welcome back. Mike in Palmer, Alaska, watching us on Free Speech TV and Direct TV. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Very well, thank you.
Appreciate your show. You were talking earlier about shaming people into voting. What a concept. Very
it's
good.
It's free. It's available.
Exactly, exactly. And the wording in it must be to the point that, well, if you don't vote, you can't complain.
Well, and Shano added something to this. He voted yesterday, and he's like, you know, if it was published in the newspaper who voted and who didn't the day after the election, I could look and see if my vote got counted.
Exactly.
And so this is actually a benefit to people. You can see whether your vote actually got counted. In this day and age of electronic voting machines, we got entire states like Georgia where there's not one single paper ballot in that state outside of, you know, the absentee ballots and things. Everybody who votes is going to vote on a touchscreen machine with no paper trail whatsoever. So how do you know if your vote even got counted?
Isn't that illegal to not have a record?
No, it's not illegal.
Well, it should be.
Yeah, it might have been arguably in some states before 2002, but with the Help America Vote Act, the George W. Bush got pushed through to hand billions of dollars to the states to give to voting machine companies, all that went out the window. We've got the most insecure, crazy voting system in the world, and we really need, and this is what Barbara Boxer is going to be talking about, we really need to be saying that there's absolute right to vote. You have a right to vote. But then the question, do you exercise that right to vote? And I think, you know, using social social shaming, as it were. And it need not even be in newspapers. I mean, maybe Facebook would publish these lists and Whitehouse.org or State Cap. You know, somebody's got to be able to publish this stuff where you can, everybody can easily find it so that I can look up whether or not my vote got recorded. And I can, and my neighbors, friends and neighbors will know that I can see whether they voted or not.
That's exactly the point. Yep.
Yeah. Good so point. Have you gotten this, Baylor? You live in Alaska.
I live in Alaska. I live in Palmer, which is about 50 miles northeast of Anchorage.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to be voting. I'll be voting when it comes about. I'm going to go in person and vote.
Right.
I'm not going to do that.
But you did not get the mailing saying
no,
that.
No, I didn't get the mailer. No, I did not get the mailer.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And again, I haven't checked the mail for a couple of days.
Well, so. But I'm guessing you're not registered as a Republican. This was a mailer that went out
I'm a registered Democrat.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, this is a mailer that went out from a white or right-wing group that was funded by a guy who's in favor of, quote, school choice, end quote, you know, privatizing education. And turning our children over to the tender mercies of the billionaires. And so odds are you won't get one. But because they're trying to shame Republicans into voting. They're trying to drive up the Republican vote. And it will work. It will work.
It will, yep. Well, hopefully it'll backfire and the Democrats will get out and vote this year.
Yeah, I hope so. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. This is such a common sense thing. It's such a common sense thing. If we know... And the social scientists did this study in 2006 in the state of Michigan, and they determined that when people know that other people can know whether or not they voted, their social conscience kicks in. And they feel like, well, you know, I really should vote. We're getting, Senator, yeah. And so it seems to me a no-brainer. Anyhow, we'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Greg Palast will be with us at the top of the hour. He's going to be talking about this new program. This is absolutely bizarre. This new thing that the Republican Secretary of State of Kansas, maybe it was the AG of Kansas, came up with, where they're taking voter lists, looking for Hispanic names, typically black names, and Asian names, comparing one state to the other and not matching middle names. It's amazing. I mean, the Republicans right now have this list of over 2 million people that they're planning on purging, or they are actively purging right now. Apropos of that, Senator Barbara Boxer is on the line with us. Boxer.senate.gov is the website, the U.S. Senator so ably representing the state of California. Senator Boxer, welcome back to the program. It's been a while.
Thanks for having me so much.
It's great to have you on. I understand we've talked a lot on this program about the right to vote and how the right to vote, you know, the Supreme Court in Bush v. Gore said you don't have a right to vote, at least not for electors for the president of the United States. And you're going to address that head on, I understand.
Well, absolutely. And frankly, the first thing I want to say is that everyone who can vote has got to get out and vote in these midterms, whether you're a Republican, a Democrat, or an independent. That's number one. Number two, I would say to the states that are trying to depress or suppress voter turnout, we are watching, and the bill that I have written is, I think, a strong one. It says if you pass a voter ID law in your state, you have to make sure it's free to the people who try to get that ID, and you give them that ID when they show up, because we have cases in Texas of people coming with all the right documentation and being told, not once, but twice, we're out of the forms.
True. I mean,
this is just so unreal, Tom. I can't believe this is actually happening in America. 21st century poll tax. Yeah. So that's the first thing we say. You got to get it to the people, and it's got to be free. And secondly, if they can't get it, because, you know, you got a lot of old people and sick people who may not be able to go down to the county, or they're just not capable of getting this on their own because they're frail, then they can go vote, sign an affidavit, penalty, of perjury, very stiff fine, or 5 years in prison, or both. If
Senator Boxer, your phone just vanished. Oh, she just vanished altogether. Yeah, she just dropped off the board. Hopefully she will call us right back. But this is great. It requires every state that has a photo ID requirement actually provide people with a voter ID. I think it needs to go beyond that even, you know, that the state will come to your house, right? I mean, it should be like Meals on Wheels. We'll come to your house and help you fill out the forms for a voter ID, because there are blind people. There are people who are not ambulatory. You've got elderly people, people who, you know, have a hard time getting around. Not to say that all blind people have a hard time getting around or aren't ambulatory, but we had the reason that's at the top of my mind is a fellow called yesterday who said that he was blind, and it had turned into this massive challenge for him to jump through all these hoops to get one of these so-called voter IDs. And it's just wrong. Okay, Senator Boxer is back with us. Senator Boxer?
I lost you in the middle of some big speech I was making.
Yeah. Well, you were saying, you know, if your state has a voter ID requirement, you must provide the people with ID. I think it should be like Meals on Wheels. We'll come to your house and give you the ID, but back to you.
Well, that's even better. But my bill doesn't even go that far. It says you need to do it, but here's the important point. If you can't get there for some reason, then you can still vote. Simply sign an affidavit as you vote that you are who you say you are. And under penalty of law, you get to vote. Because this is impossible. The stories we are hearing. One gentleman in Texas, 93, I don't know if you heard about this one, he goes, he has an expired driver's license because he's a veteran and he's 93, so he didn't get it recently. So he shows up with that and a bunch of other proof that he's who he is. He's voted his whole life and they turn him away. We said, we're really sorry. Our new law doesn't allow you to vote.
Right. If only he had a concealed carry permit, right?
Oh, agreed.
Yeah.
You can't have a student ID in Texas,
right?
But you can have a conceal and carry permit. So,
yeah.
Look, let's be clear. All you have to do is listen to Chris Christie, who I now call Dr. Christie, but he said it very clearly. He said, who do you want in control of the voting apparatus, a Democrat or a Republican? Now, whoever said that in an election? I've lived a long time. People say, do you want someone who'll raise the minimum wage? Do you want someone who'll favor tax cuts over, you know, spending? And those are issues. But Chris Christie stands up representing Republican governors, seven of whom signed the most restrictive, essentially poll tax voter ID law. And he stands up there and says to the people, who do you want in charge of the voting apparatus?
Right.
Basically, a Democrat or a Republican. This thing is unbelievable. And I'm grateful that the press is finally in the media talking about it. But it's really the issue of our time. In addition to all the other economic justice issues, this is basic to our democracy.
Yeah. Yeah, arguably the beating heart of democracy is the vote. And it was Thomas Paine said, if you take the vote away from a man, you reduce him to despotism. Here we are. Here we are.
Here we are. Here we are. And, you know, the Supreme Court opened up the door when they threw out a part of the Voting Rights Act, which said in certain states that had a pattern of discrimination, should they change their voter laws, they had to get permission, they have to show how it wouldn't be discriminatory. They threw that out. They said, oh, these are new days. Nobody discriminates.
Right.
Well, we've got it clear. They're discriminating. The Republicans are against young people, students, against poor people, against Hispanics, against African Americans, against Democrats.
And let's not forget veterans. You can't vote with a veteran's ID in Texas because our military is very multiracial.
That's an interesting point, too.
Indeed. Senator Barbara Boxer, U.S. Senator from California, boxer.senate.gov. Thanks so much for being with us, Senator.
Thank you.
And thank you for introducing this legislation. This is important stuff. We'll be back. Greg Palast is going to drop by and tell us all about this bizarre new voter suppression effort by the Republicans.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. We'll be right back.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I don't see Greg on the board. Oh, he's on
Skype.
Hey, Greg Palast.
Hey, brother man.
Our old friend, investigative reporter with BBC News, Al Jazeera, The Guardian, author. His latest book, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, his film Vultures and Vote Rustlers, is now available on DVD. Greg Palast, PALAST.com is the website. Now that I've properly introduced you, sir, tell us about this incredible story that you're working on.
Yeah, for Al Jazeera, and you can read it at aljazeera.com. See it tonight at 9 p.m. on Al Jazeera. Mm-hmm. I've discovered a new way to purge voters, now a million of them. And I want to tell you something. According to 24 Republican secretaries of state and the expert Dick Morris on Fox TV, there are 3.5 million criminal double voters, people voting twice in two different states. Now, this is a heck of a crime wave, or it's a heck of a scam. And after 6 months of investigation for Al Jazeera, I was able to actually get a hold of the list of the suspects, 2.1 million names now in our possession, which we have gone through to see who these double voting skanks are. And it turns out, Tom, that there are exactly zero double voters on the list. None. But there are 3 million people, overwhelmingly African-American, Hispanics, and Asian-Americans, who are at risk of losing their votes because they've been falsely accused of voting twice. Virginia alone, one single state, has already removed 41,000 people from the voter rolls. 500,000 are at risk in the battleground state of Georgia, 190,000 at risk in the battleground state of North Carolina, and this whole scam was generated in the battleground state of Kansas by the Republican Secretary of State, Kris Kobach, the kind of Catherine Harris of 2014.
How is this not a crime?
Well, they're claiming a lot of you guys, especially if you have a darker tint to your skin, are committing this felony crime. By the way, it's 2 to 10 years in the slammer for voting twice. But I got to tell you, we've gone through the list very carefully with a set of experts. Number one, we flew down to North Carolina where they've hired a famous ex-FBI agent, Chuck Stuber, who's had his 190,000 suspects for 6 months. He has their addresses. He has their phone numbers. He has their names, signatures, place of work. And he knows where they vote, of course. And he hasn't arrested a single person. And the answer is because no one on that list is actually voting twice. It's simply a list of common names like David Lee, Sue Park Kim, Jorge Rodriguez, Joseph Washington. The only match, the only thing that makes two voters supposedly the same person voting twice is the first and last name. It's been a big scam because the Secretary of State of Kansas, Kobach, who's in his own fight for his re-election life on Tuesday, has said they use Social Security numbers. There's not one Social Security number on the list. They say that they match middle names. There are 1.5 million people with mismatched middle names. In fact, I don't know. I'll show you this list here if you can see it.
Wow.
It's random. This is random. Kris Jarvis Jackson is supposedly the same person as Kris Laquan Jackson in another state. There are, by the way, there are 86,020 people named John Jackson. It is not 86,000 votes cast by one guy named John Jackson, but that's literally how they're running this list. I kid you not. I mean, it's so slapstick, you can laugh, except it could change the United States Senate, and it could easily change the presidency.
Wow. And this is actually, I don't think this is anything new, Greg. I mean, this is what Jeb Bush did with Katherine Harris in 2000 to get his brother within 500 votes of stealing an election. I mean, he knocked 80,000 African Americans off the voting roll. You were investigating that for BBC.
That was my story. Yeah, that was my story back. That's why I recognized this right off as soon as I heard about this, because I did the story in 2000 for BBC and The Guardian that Jeb Bush and Katherine Harris knocked off tens of thousands of black voters off the voter rolls just before the presidential race, calling them felons, criminals not allowed to vote. And by the way, very few people have asked me whatever happened to those criminals. It turns out the state of Florida said there were maybe six out of, in the end, 94,000 people, maybe six who voted incorrectly. And then they checked. They said, oh, no, actually, those six are allowed to vote, too. Not one illegal voter. And I'm looking at this list. I've asked the FBI agent in charge. It said, how many people have you arrested after 6 months? You've got their names and addresses and everything. Not one, not even a single recommendation of an indictment, because it's nothing but common names. And by the way, if the FBI can't find these people, I did. I went and found, let's see, there was James. Here we are. Kevin Thomas Hayes voted in Virginia. And he's supposed to be the same guy as Kevin Antonio Hayes, who voted in North Carolina. So I went and found this ne'er-do-well double voter, Mr. Kevin Antonio Hayes, in North Carolina. And I said, so, have you voted in another state under using a different middle name? And he said, he was a little sheepish about it because his mother, he's a young man, his mother said angrily, he didn't vote at all in the last election. And sure enough, by the way, here's what's really sick. Right in the cross-check computer file, right in there, it says he didn't vote in the last election. So he's on a list of criminal double voters, yet they know that he actually didn't vote at all. And what they're doing is they're taking away the voting rights of tens of thousands, actually hundreds of thousands of minority voters, 41,000 in Virginia alone. Georgia won't tell us how many they've taken off. North Carolina won't tell us how many they've taken off. They're going through a process. Well, don't worry about it. We send people a postcard. If they sign off that they really are the right voter, they get to keep their vote.
That's caging.
Yeah, well, it's junk mail. People throw it out. And also, you know, like a fifth of the not only is this list junk, but they've confused the addresses on about a fifth of the names, where they transpose the names and numbers, et cetera. So a lot of those cards are going to come back. In North Carolina, if your card comes back undelivered, you lose your vote automatically. You don't return your card, you lose your vote. Like I say, it's about a tenth to a fifth.
So we're looking at a couple million people who are going to lose their vote. If they have early voted, does their vote get removed? Is that the deal?
They're going to find out that they can't vote at all. They'll have to get a provisional ballot. And as you know, most provisional ballots just get
They're just placebo
garbage.
Ballots.
Yeah, you know, they make you feel good. You say, your name's on a list. Don't worry, you can vote on a provisional ballot. No thanks. Make sure you fight for that, for a real ballot. But please, if you do get a card, if you have a common name and you get a card in the mail, don't ignore it, please. Because, right. You know, I went to Martin Luther King's old church, the King Church, Ebenezer Baptist in Atlanta, which was the center of this conspiracy of double voters. They have an old age home next to the church, African American elderly. They, according to the cross-check system, 10 people in that old age home are criminal double voters. I found one, a Mr. Naylor, who happened to have his Bible open on his kitchen table. He puts his hand on his Bible and he says, I swear I didn't vote twice. And in fact, he said he filed a sworn witness, a legal affidavit to get his vote back that he had to send off to the state of Louisiana, where they said he was voting as well as in Atlanta from the old age home. So what they're doing is that they're running people through a maze. It's like a voter ID demand with bullets. And a lot of people are just not going to go through that, won't even know that they're on the list It's another minority scrub. I saw it with the alien voters in 2012. Come on.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. Greg, can you stick around for a bit?
Yes.
Cool. Greg Pallas is with us, investigative reporter with BBC, Al Jazeera, The Guardian, and our show, apparently. He says his latest book, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, his film, Vultures and Vote Wrestlers, is now out on DVD. You can find it all at gregpallas.com. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, for this story and all the details that Greg was just telling you about, go to Greg Pallas, GREGPALAST.com. And welcome back. Greg, we were just talking with Barbara Boxer, Senator Barbara Boxer. You're still here, right?
Yes, yeah. I'm with you.
We just literally 20 minutes ago had a 10-minute conversation with Barbara Boxer, who is introducing legislation or is trying to introduce legislation. If the Republicans take the Senate, it's not going to go very far. But that would require states that pass voter suppression ID laws to actually provide people with voter IDs. She told the story of a couple of people in Texas who kept trying to get their voter IDs and kept being told that, in fact, one guy repeatedly, that, I'm sorry, we don't have the forms, so you can't get your free ID. After he went through all these, jumping through all these hoops and all this other kind of stuff. What do you see as, what do you think about Barbara Boxer's suggested legislation? I think we should go a lot farther. I think we should have a constitutional amendment that explicitly says we have a right to vote, so that you're messing with a right, not a privilege. The Supreme Court has said that voting is merely a privilege in the United States. So people like, was it Chris Kobach, was it you said?
Yeah, Chris Kobach.
Yeah, so people like Chris Kobach can mess with your vote. What are your thoughts on remedies?
Well, first of all, I spoke with Martin Luther King III when I was down in Atlanta. And he said, look, this goes back to the Voting Rights Act written at this table that I was sitting at. The problem is that when you eliminated so-called preclearance of several states, including, by the way, New York and Alaska, and not just the southern states, they could get away with this shenanigans until that law, until the Supreme Court kicked Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act in the teeth, saying that you had that states like Georgia and North Carolina have to pre-clear changes to make sure that they don't attack voters of color in particular. Because this would have never gone through this cross-check junk, right? But the answer is there's a simple change that would meet the constitutional bar, which is that, and it was proposed by Justice Kennedy, have all states pre-clear all changes. States like Ohio, who were never on the pre-clearance list, their voting systems are vicious, brutal, and racist, and everyone should be on the list. The city of New York actually wrote a note to the court, a friend of the court brief, saying, we have pre-clearance in New York City, just like Mississippi, and we have no problem with it. We just tell the Justice Department if we're changing some voting rule or procedure. We have no problems because we don't target the black voters for elimination. If you have no problem, if you're not trying to get rid of your voters of color, it's nothing to send a short letter saying, here's a change we're making. It's no big deal. Why shouldn't it apply to every single state? Because we see these games played in Kansas, in Ohio, in Colorado. You're seeing this game all over. And by the way, if you want to see if you are on the double voter list, we have 1 million names of double voters, so-called, uploaded to the Al Jazeera computers. Just go to my story at aljazeera.com. In the middle of the story, there's a box. Type in your name and see if you are a criminal on the lam being hunted by Chris Kobach and the Republican secretaries of state. You are subject to losing your vote. It's not a joke.
Wow. This is serious stuff. I mean, this is really serious stuff. And you're doing some really, really great reporting on this, Greg. After the break, I want to ask you about what I think may be something that will, A, give us an opportunity to get a handle on this, and B, might encourage more people to vote. So stick around. Greg Pallas with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Greg Pallas on the line with us. Greg, I wanted to run a possible solution to some of this stuff past you. But first, I had one other question I wanted to ask you. How? What is the criteria that these Republican secretaries of state are using to determine who gets on this list of so-called double voter felons?
Well, as our expert in list maintenance told us, their criteria is crazy. It's literally if your first and last name matches that of another voter. There's an awful lot of Joseph Whites and Joseph Blacks on this list.
So basically what it's going after is common names.
It's going after common names, and here's the brilliance of it. It wouldn't matter if it was kind of pulling off millions of voters randomly. It would be ugly, but it wouldn't matter. The thing is, according to the United States Census, which tracks the ethnic breakdown of every single surname in America, by the way, which you can get, we use that. If you are a voter of color, the chance that you are using one of the 1,000 most common names in America is 80% higher than if you're white. So they know if they have a common name match system.
Right.
And they're going to get heavily, heavily minority lists. And like I say, it's only first and last name. I just, you know, it's random. I'm looking at this goofy list.
Right.
William J. Johnson is supposed to be the same voter as William Edmund Johnson.
Wow.
So how many Bill Johnsons are there in America? Actually, there's 86,020 John Jacksons.
So here's my suggestion. First of all, a little backstory. Back in 2006, there were a couple of political scientists in the Michigan who were looking at the Michigan primary, and they wondered, could we increase voter turnout by pointing out to people that the fact of whether they voted or not is a matter of public record? And so they sent out mailings to a selected number of people. This was Hal Malchow who did this. The Times wrote about this back in 2010. And they sent out this letter to people saying, you are registered to vote. Here's your address. And here's the elections that you voted in. And we will update this list after the election and let you know whether your vote was counted or not, whether you voted or not. And by the way, here's the list of your neighbors, all the people on your block. So what it did is it brought social pressure to voting. And it increased voter turnout 10 times better. I'm quoting from the New York Times. The mailer was 10 times better at turning non-voters into voters than the typical piece of pre-election mail whose effectiveness has ever been measured. So, A, that kind of social pressure works. B, it's being used right now. Democrats in New York State are mailing out a similar letter to registered Democrats saying, you know, we're watching you, basically. Are you going to vote or not? And Republicans, or at least a right-wing group up in Alaska, is mailing out these things to registered Republicans in Alaska, knowing that these letters are going to cause people to vote. What if we took it a step further and said these lists will be published? We could create a website, you know, GregPalastVotingInfo.com, and create a website, because this is all public documents, right?
It is all
so
public,
that,
yes.
So that the
all
day right. after the election, I can go on this list, and I can see if my vote was recorded. And, you know, it doesn't tell who you voted for, but it tells whether or not you voted. And it accomplishes two things. Number one, it brings that social pressure to people. Hey, everybody's going to know whether you voted or not, so I think I'll vote. It's going to increase the number of voters. But more importantly, I can see if they robbed me of my vote. What do you think?
That's why they're not going to do it, Tom.
Well,
you know, people
I think the Democratic Party should do this.
Yeah, I think that they ought to.
Or maybe you and I should do this.
You know what's happening? The only where it's really happening is in the churches. That's why you have actually a place like Georgia. You have a higher African-American turnout than white turnout in elections as a percentage of eligible voters, believe it or not. With all the impediments, with all the scrubs, the fake felon scrubs, the fake double voter scrubs, all the IDs, all that stuff. Still, African-Americans are voting at higher levels because of souls to the polls on Sundays. Before elections, people are growing in groups. Get in the church bus. And if you're not getting in the church bus, they're going to say, why aren't you getting in the bus?
Right. It's that social pressure that I was just talking about.
Exactly. And so, of course, they hate that. That's why Republicans are trying to stop early voting, because it means stopping the black church vote. They know it. And it's still happening. So they say, OK, well, we got another game. We can say all those people in the bus, they all have the same name. They're all Washington and Jackson. So let's just say they're all double voting. They're all the same person.
Right.
And take away their vote. That's what this is all about.
Yeah, but wouldn't it be great if all the Mr. Jacksons on that bus could check the newspaper or check a website the day after the election and see if their vote counted?
Well, that would, you know what? That would also prevent a lot of the stuff. As you know, we have about 2 million votes a year are spoiled. That is, they're not counted because they're supposedly unreadable.
Right.
Because someone circled Al Gore instead of putting a check next to his name.
Right. And people don't know. They don't know if their vote was spoiled because they don't know that they can look this up as a matter of public record.
Yeah, well, for Oregon and New York will tell you, for example, if you have a provisional ballot that was actually counted. People fill out these ballots, they think they're counted, and you have a right to challenge if you're in Oregon, if your vote was chucked away. But we don't have that in the states that are these battleground states like North Carolina, Georgia, Kansas. This is where they're making it hard to even know if your vote counted. You know, this, you're absolutely right. We want both social pressure and honesty. Good luck.
Right. Yeah. Well, this is where I think the Democratic Party might be interested. I don't know. I need to make a sales pitch to Barbara Boxer, I guess. Greg Pallas, great work you're doing, my friend. You are brilliant. Thanks so much for dropping by today. Greg?
Oh. Yep.
Okay.
Good night.
Thank you. Okay. You too. GregPallas.com. Be sure to check it out.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And apparently my.aljazeera.com .com. Yeah, there we go. You can check that out, too. We'll be right back. This is amazing. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk media for the rest of us. Shane pulled up while we were talking with Greg Pallas. And where is this list? This is at my.aljazeera.com, or is it just aljazeera.com? Projects.aljazeera.com. Thank you. Is this huge voter list, the millions of people. I'm doing this show from an office in Washington, D.C., and we have a full-time staff of three people, right? We've got Jim running video. We've got Shano running the audio. We've got Danielle answering the phones and whatnot. And just keeping everything running. And so these three folks represent 100% of our staff who are physically here. I mean, obviously we've got people all over the country who actually all over the world. Sue is in the UK, running our chat room, but just these three people, all three of them have somebody who they're related to on the list. Shane just looked at his last name, at Danielle's last name, and at Jim's last name. And he found Jim's parents on there. He found his own cousin on there. Who has a different last name, but your cousin, and your cousin lives in Georgia, in one of the cities that is either largely African American or largely students. And Danielle's cousin, uncle, Danielle's uncle was on there. This is a huge list, and really, what it's measuring is apparently in each one of these cases is just double registration. When I move, I've moved a lot in my life. I grew up in Michigan. When I was 27, Louise and I moved from Michigan to New Hampshire. We lived in New Hampshire for 5 years. Then we moved to Georgia. We lived there for 13 years. We then moved to Vermont. We lived there for 10 years. We moved from Vermont to Oregon. We lived there for 5 years. We moved to Washington, D.C. We've been here 4 years. Until we moved to D.C., and I registered to vote in Washington, D.C., I have never canceled the voter registration of the state that I moved from. Because, A, I didn't know I should or even that I could. And, B, I figured, hey, it doesn't matter. You know, I no longer live there. In fact, I had always assumed that when you register to vote in a new state, they notify the old state. Well, all this sturm and drang of the Republicans caused me to go, oh, this is interesting. There's something else going on here. And so when we moved to D.C., just figuring, you know, I'm probably under more scrutiny than most people because I'm a public figure, I sent a letter to Oregon saying I'm no longer living in your state. I never got a response, by the way. So I don't know what they, but it's so bizarre. Most of these are people who move. And they're registered in two states. Well, that doesn't mean that they're going to vote in two states. So anyway, I think that the solution for this is to publish the lists of who voted and who didn't. So that everybody can see it, including the people who voted, so that you can see if your vote has been stolen by the Republicans. And that has the added benefit of creating that kind of social pressure that at the souls to the polls, the people have when they go to church, and after the church service, it's like, hey, everybody, let's get on the bus and go vote. And somebody says, no, I don't think I will. Well, what's wrong with you? Right? As Greg Palast pointed out. So, Amy in Madison, Wisconsin, listening on 92.1, the mic. Hey, Amy.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to update you on what's going on here.
Okay.
First of all, the Marquette University, which does good polling, had a very bad poll. Among likely voters, Walker has 50% and Maryburg 43%, but among registered voters, they're almost tied.
Wow. So, which means that all the registered voters need to get out to vote.
Yeah. Now, there are 39,000, because I go to the local Dems meeting once a month, 39,000 people in Dane County didn't vote in 2010, and that would have made the difference, and Walker would never have been elected.
Right.
So what we are doing is going to all the people that voted in 2008 and 2012 but didn't vote in 2010. Mm-hmm. And we are targeting those people and giving them cards to pledge that they will vote and we'll send back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where all our efforts have been on getting what are typically Democratic voters to try to persuade them to vote.
Right. Well, good on you,
there
Amy.
There is a gender gap both ways,
yeah.
But the Walker gender gap among men is much bigger than the women gender gap with Mary Burke.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Amy, thank you for the heads up and thank you for the update. If you're in Wisconsin, get out to vote. Stephen in Salem, Ohio. Hey, Stephen, what's up?
Oh, my gosh. You got to me quick.
Hello? Stephen's not there. Aiden in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Aiden, what's up? Uh-oh. Did our phones just crash? Yeah. Okay, so this is what happens when you have Comcast as your internet provider, and some of your phone equipment is operating on the internet. It's incredible. Okay, let me just go through the calls here and see if anybody can hear me. Carla in Greenville, North Carolina, can you hear me, Carla?
You bet.
Okay, great. You are on the air.
I am here to talk about voter fraud in North Carolina, which I'm seeing now. I got my new voter registration card in the mail. I read it, and it said, oh, you have to go to a new place to vote after the past 30 years of going to where I always go. I said, fine. So I reached out to all my friends, both sides of the aisle. I said, check where you're voting. My friend called. She said, oh, God, Carla, they're sending me to another town to vote. She said, I'd have never noticed it. But they're making me go to another town. So she and her son yesterday go to early vote in the other town where they're met with people who have real ballots already filled out. And they walk up to them and say, oh, it's so difficult to vote this year. Here's your ballot already filled out. All you have to do is go in and turn it in. And she looked at it, and, of course, they were already filled out, all Republican. And she started laughing, and she said, no way am I going to give you my vote.
She needed to whip out a cell phone and videotape that. That's
exactly
astonishing.
I wish I had thought of that.
Yeah.
She's trying to now go through the proper channels to complain, and she's getting the complete runaround because, as you know, our state of North Carolina has sort of been hijacked. And it's amazing to me. I'm amazed that someone could get their hands on actual ballots and then fill them out and pass them out.
Right. It's astonishing.
It is.
It's
astonishing. And I'm a Barbara Boxer. Thank you for having her on.
My pleasure. Carla, thanks for sharing that story with us. Wow. Thank you. Aiden in Chicago, you want to try it again?
Yeah, hi. Long-time listener. Had an idea that's been rolling around my head for quite a few years. If you tie voting to the IRS, which is you have a $100 premium to vote, but if you do vote, you get a $100 tax cut.
Hmm.
That means that the IRS goes after the voter caters.
Right, and so the IRS would actually have to keep track of the voter rolls to see who voted, and if you voted, you get a $100 tax credit, the same as you know, if you have a child, you get a $2,000 or $3,000 tax credit or whatever it is these days.
Or the same as a self-employment tax.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a good idea, too. Although I really think that tying money to votes is, even if you're paying people to vote, essentially, is going to raise questions about the...
Yeah, but you can use that money then to actually pay for, like, universal voting machines or to actually pay for people to register people to vote.
Yeah.
That's the actual money gathered for that.
Well, this wouldn't gather money. This would pass money out. Fund.
It takes it in and uses it maybe to pay for employing people to get everybody registered, maybe by...
No, the system you described, Aiden, is not going to raise revenue. It's going to deplete government coffers because you're giving money back to taxpayers.
Well,
But you
raise it if you do vote, you get a tax cut. It's the people that couldn't be arsed to vote get the $100 taken out of their tax returns.
Right. Right. Very interesting.
It's almost like a way around like the Australian fine version, but it's kind of not as harsh.
Yeah. No, I think it's probably a great idea. I need to ponder it a little bit, but again, it's, you know, the Republicans are in charge. It ain't going to happen. Aiden, thank you for the call. Stephen in Salem, Ohio. We got a minute to the break, Stephen. It's all yours.
Okay. 1976, I did an absentee ballot from the Demilitarized Zone in Korea. Mm-hmm. Ever since then, I have voted presidential elections and tried to make the elections in between. And I've never, ever seen anything like this. This is... Are you having trouble hearing me?
No, you say it's just fine, Stephen.
Crackling on the phone.
It's just fine.
Okay, great. I like listening to that Mr. Palace, and what he tells me sends shivers up my spine because I don't have long to live, but I do not want to see the way things are going for my grandchildren. This is awful, and what it tells me is somebody is very fearful that they are going to lose power.
You're absolutely right. Stephen, thank you for the call. This, in fact, this is what it's come down to. The only way that the Republicans can gain or hold power is by fraud, is by preventing people from voting. This is election fraud, not voter fraud, election fraud. 2 million people kicked off the polls?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
This is truly astonishing research that's been done by Greg Palast and Al Jazeera. That this is being run out of Kansas, and it's nationwide. It's astonishing. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Don in Lakeport, California. Hey, Don, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network.
It's good. I watch you all the time.
Thank you.
On the voter ID, why don't we use Social Security cards and sign in on that? That way you're not getting two people at the same time, you know, with the middle names being different.
Sure. If there was any problem with people voting twice.
Yeah, I know. I don't believe in it, but... Yeah.
Well, it's not even a matter of believing it. I mean, just imagine who among us is going to risk 5 years in prison and have to make two trips to the polls, you know, presumably on different days at different times so you don't see the same poll worker, just to cast an illegal vote. I mean, that's insane. Nobody's going to do that.
It's just a talking point, I guess, for the next time.
It's part of the fevered, paranoid imagination of the Republican right, the base of the Republican right, that has been spoon-fed to them by Fox News right-wing talk show hosts and the right-wing media. And it's just amazing. But, there's a lot of ways to solve the problem of people voting twice if there was a problem of people voting twice.
Exactly.
There is no such problem. And so what we really need to do is just go back to the system where when you register, you show some identification that demonstrates who you are and that you actually live where you say you live. And, you know, and throughout the years, wherever I've registered to vote, it's been an electric bill or a rent receipt or, you know, a mortgage statement, something like that. And your ID. And when you register and then you leave your signature, and then now you've got a biometric marker, which is your signature. Signatures are harder to forge than pretty much anything else. And so in the future, when you go back, you just sign the paper and they compare your signature and they say, okay, you're you. You go ahead and vote. And
yeah, well, we don't have that problem in California, so.
Yeah, well, it's just, it's astonishing. Don, thank you for the call. Steve in Buchanan Dam, Texas. Hey, Steve, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
First time, long time. I just wanted to thank you for everything you do for the cause, number one.
Thank you, Steve.
I'm a 57-year-old retired engineer from a large oil company, and I'm not exactly, you know, the stereotypical person that would be targeted from the voting thing. I entered my early voting polling location the other day and was asked to produce the photo ID, which I did in the form of a driver's license and a voter's registration. And the woman there basically asked me a question in the form of a command, which was, I need for you to recite your full address for me before moving further, which, being a go-along kind of guy, I did. And then after doing it, I thought, this can't be legal for them to extrapolate this even further than they already have.
Yeah. Huh. I don't know if that's part of the Texas voter suppression law or not. I mean, it makes sense if you're trying to verify that a person is who they say they are, that they should be able to tell you their address. But, you know, again, it's just this enormous waste of time. There is no epidemic of people voting twice. The closest that they can even get to this is in the states where felons no longer have the vote. You've got every year you'll have 2, 3, 4 felons in each one of these states who voted without realizing that they weren't eligible to vote because they had committed a felony. And, you know, these are just simple mistakes, and they're not going to influence an election. So, Steve, you know, thanks for sharing your story with me. This is just, you know, Rick Perry does not want you to vote, right? If the more that they can suppress the vote, as Paul Weyrich famously said, and our leverage in the elections quite candidly goes up as the voter populace goes down. It's that simple. We'll be back with Bob Newton. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Bob Ney is with us, author of Sideswiped and reporter for the Talk Radio News Service. Congressman, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. I hope the same is true of you.
Yes, it is. I'm listening to this conversation. It's taking me back 12 years. Steny Hoyer yesterday, then number two Democratic leader of the House, put out a note about the 12-year anniversary of the Help America Vote Act, which I authored that bill, and it set up nationally everything you would need for an ID. The last 4 of your Social Security, a slip from your electric bill, something of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
It set everything up. So it is in federal law, and it has an attestation if you're a citizen or not. That's in federal law. And the idea is not to purge everybody. The idea is if somebody signs up, they aren't a citizen, you have them where they falsified the document, and you pursue it
right, legally. Right.
And so it's all set up. And one of the stories I have today is about this purge, which doesn't need to be done. And so, you know, the federal law, the Help America Vote Act, was really something that provides what they need. This is truly people who are afraid of voters. So they're trying to get that certain name off the ballot that doesn't look like a name that'll vote for them.
Yeah.
It's midterm madness.
It really is. And here we've got Chris Kobach out of the state of Kansas running this 2 to 3 million name voter database, largely African Americans and Hispanics, that Republican governors around the country are using to purge their voting rolls in these Republican controlled states.
That's
astonishing.
Right. And then Al Jazeera found that, what, a fourth, 23% or so, of the accused voters lacked matching middle names.
Right, right. Yeah, it's a nonsense list. I mean, this is exactly how Jeb Bush and Catherine Harris did it in 2000 in Florida. With Greg Palast was on our show earlier. He was the guy who did the initial reporting on that for BBC, and he said that it was 97,000 people, virtually all of them African Americans, who got knocked off the voting rolls in Florida just weeks before the 2000 election. That was 90,000 votes, probably would have turned into 20, 30, 40,000 votes for Al Gore that were not, you know, those people were given provisional ballots. They probably didn't even know that their vote was never counted, and got George W. Bush within stealing range of the election.
Exactly. So it's It's intact in the federal law, and the states have just gone crazy trying to suppress the vote. And
yeah, it's nuts.
I did want to mention this story. Here's a man who maybe looks in the mirror and thinks he might be president of the United States, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham. I don't know if you've carried this story yet.
I have not, but go for it. I know what you're talking about.
He's toying, of course, with the idea of being president of the United States, and they have him on tape. Senator Graham better realize this is the world of iPhones and tapes, et cetera. And he was quoted at a gathering this month, and I listened to the tape myself, and it says, "White men who are in male-only clubs are going to do great in my presidency." White men in male-only clubs are going to do great in my presidency. Now, he goes on to make some jokes about Baptists, et cetera, but that comment in itself, and he says, well, it's a light atmosphere, you're supposed to joke, but talk about stereotypical.
I don't think that's the kind of stuff you joke about.
No. White men who are in male-only clubs are going to do great in my presidency. So it may not cost him his election, but it surely may not obviously help if he's supposed to be one of the top leaders, you know, as he follows John McCain around the Senate, it surely is not going to help.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the big story of the day, Tom, we've been talking about is the fact of the what's going to happen in Maine and what will happen with, you know, the governor, of course, who's up for election. You've got the science of Ebola and you have the politics of Ebola. And he is trying his best to get the judge to issue that order, which would mean that Ms. Hickok would have to be, you know, quarantined. Of course, she said she's going to fight this in an appeals court.
Right.
I don't know if he'll win the order or not, but he is full force trying to pursue.
Yeah, she went out for a bike ride today, and they had the police follow her, but they couldn't arrest her because they don't have a court order yet.
I know. And then the other thing I wanted to note is that Speaker Boehner, one of my favorite topics, and I've actually wrote on his Facebook page today, he's not going to be happy, but Speaker Boehner ended up saying that he was basically, let me paraphrase this, you know, outraged of the profanity in the White House with the staffer who used profanity when it came to what they thought of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Right.
I just thought it was.
Isn't Speaker Boehner, doesn't he, when you were a member of Congress and you were hanging out with him, doesn't he swear like a lot?
Oh, I wrote on his Facebook that I understand the issue about working with respect between two countries, but really, Mr. Speaker, you have the foulest mouth on Capitol Hill. Everybody knows it. And what I wrote this on, this is right on his Facebook. I put my name on it.
Yeah.
And I said, I know I'm a felon and a liar and I'm sad, but a lot of non-liars, non-sad people and non-felons know you say the F word like it's your job.
Wow.
And he does, Tom. Everybody on the Hill knows this. Everybody listening to this that's ever met him knows it. He says it to people all the time.
Wow.
All the time in the meetings, in his office. And when I read that about him, you know, the profanity in the White House, I thought, you've really got to be kidding me.
Well, he knows that that'll get pushed out via Fox News and Drudge and right-wing news sources where there won't be any challenging voices. There won't be anybody saying what you're saying. It'll be presented in a vacuum, and people will think, oh, that guardian of morality, John Boehner, you know, that teetotaler, he's trying to protect this from an obscene president.
I had to write on this wall. I know I'll probably be audited or something, but I had to.
Yeah,
and
good
then,
on you.
And then the last one is midterm madness. They're already fighting if they take control of the Senate, because they think there's some tsunami. But if they take control, they are already internally fighting about who's going to run the place and what's going to happen to Mitch McConnell. So the, you know, eat your own alive is already beginning before they really know the outcome.
Wow. Wow.
Yes.
So what do you think is going to happen, Bob?
I don't think there's a tsunami. I think the House will gain maybe about 8 or 10 seats. The Senate is just too close to call. One seat may be either direction. It's going to be pure voter turnout, period.
Right.
And if the Democratic base can turn out, right now the Republicans honestly, technically should be so far ahead, and they simply aren't. They didn't do what they needed to do. They harped on Obamacare. It began to work, and they were without issues.
Right.
So there's races like Georgia's should never be close for a Democratic contender, but it is.
Right. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, author of Sideswiped. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome to our third hour. I am honored to have James Risen with me in the studio today for this hour. Investigative journalist, author. He's got a new book out, Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. The former New York Times reporter, or current?
Current.
Former and current New York Times reporter. There you go. You, in your new book, well, first of all, probably the thing that you're most famous for is that the Bush administration and now the Obama administration have gone after you.
Right.
You want to tell us that story?
Well, not really. No, I'm just kidding. It's been going on for so long, and it's kind of hard to remember, you know, where to start with it. They've been going after me for 7 years now.
No, this goes back to your State of War, wasn't it, that book?
My book, State of War, yeah. You know, which came out in 2006, got subpoenaed as part of a criminal leak investigation based on a chapter in that book. And I first got subpoenaed by the Bush administration and now since then by the Obama administration.
Right.
And
they basically want you to reveal your source.
Yeah, I mean, well, I have refused to testify in that case.
Well, that's something reporters don't do. I mean, we need to have a media shield law in this country.
Right, yeah. And there is no federal shield law.
Now, Eric Holder a couple of days ago said, no reporter is going to go to jail on my watch. Is that good news that he said it, or is it bad news because he knows that he's leaving office in a few weeks?
I don't know what's going on with the government. You know, the case is kind of up in the air right now. It's unclear what's really going to happen.
Yeah. Well, you're stirring up some activity. People are talking about it. People are waking up, I think. Freedom, the Fourth Estate, the whole idea of freedom of the press, it's the only industry that's mentioned in the Constitution because it's essentially the check on government.
Right, right. And that's why, you know, I wrote this new book was kind of that's my response to the government. I'm going to keep writing, keep exercising my First Amendment rights, and keep investigating the government.
We're talking with New York Times reporter, Pulitzer Prize winner, aren't you?
Yep.
Yeah. Pulitzer Prize winning author James Risen. And his new book, Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. Pay Any Price is a phrase that John Kennedy used in, was it his inaugural?
Yeah, in his only inaugural, in which he said, you know, we pay any price to protect freedom around the world and democracy around the world. But in this war on terror, we've paid an enormous price. I think the Americans have to step back now and think about what have we gotten in 13 years of endless war?
Yeah.
13 years after 9/11, we've had roughly $4 trillion spent in the war on terror.
Mm-hmm.
We've had thousands of American lives lost in American soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere. And I'm not sure what we have to show for it other than having transformed our society and created a new national security state.
Well, that $4 trillion came from somewhere and went somewhere. So it came from taxpayers by and large, and it went to this is why if you go just 10 miles north of here or right. south of here, wherever Virginia is,
right.
into the Virginia suburbs there. You can drive around. In fact, Tom Frank, who wrote What's the Matter with Kansas, was on my TV show, I don't know, maybe a year ago. And he had just gone down there with a video camera.
Uh-huh.
And he was just documenting how there are like miles of these 20 and 30 bedroom mansions
right, right.
that are owned by senior executives and these defense contractors.
Right. Yeah, that I point out in the in my book that I think the I forget the exact six or eight of the richest counties in America are now in the Washington area.
Right.
There's been a huge transfer of wealth from American taxpayers to defense, national security, intelligence, and counterterrorism contractors, and to just more generally to the defense establishment around Washington. And it's odd because, you know, Republicans and conservatives like to talk about deficit spending and cutting the deficit. But nobody ever talks about cutting back this mammoth national security apparatus we've created since 9/11 because they're afraid of looking soft on terrorism. That's like the one sacred cow that both Democrats and Republicans observe is we don't want to look like we're soft on terror. And so as a result, all this keeps going with very little oversight.
There was a just to show how absurd this can get. There was a piece of legislation back a decade or so ago introduced into the House of Representatives that attached some sort of draconian government, intrusive government measures to use against a quote against child pornography. Mm-hmm. But it was like just way beyond the pale. It was just somebody
right.
pandering.
Right.
Bernie Sanders voted against it, as did most of the members of the House. It never passed, never went anywhere. In his last run for the House of Representatives, I was living in Vermont at the time, and in his last run for the House of Representatives, his Republican opponent ran ads saying that Bernie Sanders was in favor of child pornography.
Yeah.
I mean, and right.
That's the kind of ads you can run against people who vote against, you know, funding for counterterrorism programs.
This is the new child porn. This
right.
is the this
right.
is the equivalent
yeah.
of it.
Right.
Who dares say, oh, no, I think we should dial back the national security state.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, it's made it very difficult to have reasoned debate in the United States today about the war on terror. And that's really why I wrote the book. I've got very frustrated with the level of and the quality of the debate we're having in this country about it. You know, generally the media has just engaged in kind of has cooperated with the fear mongering. And so no one really ever steps back and says, wait a second, what are we doing to ourselves?
Right.
You know, I just noticed a fact today in The Intercept, you know, online news.
Glenn Greenwald's newsletter.
Right. And they had a story and one fact that just struck me, a very sad fact, that this young Marine who was just killed in Iraq in this new operation we now have in Iraq.
Right.
He's 19 years old. And he was 6 years old at the time in 9/11.
Whoa.
And that just struck me as a perfect example of what we're now in. We're in an endless cycle of war.
Well, and apropos of that, or speaking to that, George Orwell wrote 1984. And, you know, when I was in high school, I read the Cliff Notes version so I could pass the test. I didn't read the book.
Right.
But back about 15 years ago, I was giving a speech I was doing a tour of Australia, big cities in Australia, promoting a new book that had come out. And I found a copy of 1984 in a hotel I was staying in, and kind of one of these, you know, take one, leave one places. Mm-hmm. I thought, I haven't read this book. I ought to read it. I started reading it, and between that and the jet lag, I was having the wildest nightmares. I had to stop reading the book. I mean, it was so depressing. And the storyline of that book, 1984, is that there's now perpetual war.
Right.
And that's
right.
used to justify this perpetual national surveillance state.
Right.
Are we there?
Well, we've gone down that road. Hopefully, I mean, I'm still somewhat optimistic that we can find a way to turn it around. But, you know, one of the things that Orwell points out is how useful endless war is to create a dictatorship or an authoritarian regime. And that's what happens in that book.
Right.
Endless war becomes useful for political purposes, for repression. And that's kind of the history, not just fiction. That's the history of empires throughout history. The Roman Empire, the British Empire, all these various empires have, once you become a global empire, you tend to have more of an elite power structure.
And you have more enemies, so you're more likely to be constantly at war. Right. James Risen is with us, Pulitzer Prize winning New York Times reporter. His new book, Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
James Risen's book is available at all the usual suspects, your favorite bookstore, your online place, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Powell's, whatever it may be. Check it out. Pay Any Price by James Risen. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and James Risen with us. And I just had this. This is the only book that I've written that's a comic book. But here we go. This is James Madison.
Uh-huh, right.
No nation can preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare.
Right. That's the challenge we're now facing. Can we find a way to do it? And I think one of the central themes of my book is that after 9/11, we had this, what we thought of at the time as the Bush-era counterterrorism programs. Mm-hmm. Dick Cheney and George Bush created a whole series of new operations, a surveillance state, secret prisons, detention, enemy combatants, whatever, what have you. And those looked like at the time as temporary measures. And now what we see is that Barack Obama's legacy is that he's made him permanent. He's normalized the war on terror and made it bipartisan, made it much more difficult for either Democrats or Republicans to criticize because both their parties are deeply invested in it now.
I forget who the quote is attributed to. It seems like maybe it was one of the German philosophers, that power once taken is never yielded without a fight, or words to that.
Yeah, point. Yeah.
And it, when you start a new program, it's acquiring more power, isn't it?
Right, exactly. And that's what I think Obama has shown, that executive power is very difficult to give up. Once you become the person who is in charge and gets all the power, you don't want to be the one to give it up.
Well, and that was Madison's quote. His quote starts out by saying, war is the most pernicious of all the influences because it enhances the power of the executive, his power to grant emoluments, his power to, he had a list of three things. And then he goes on to say, no nation in the midst of perpetual war can maintain its freedom. It is a grim possibility. What in your mind should we be doing?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do, I think the only thing that will get us out of this cycle is if the American people begin to become more skeptical about terror threats and not be so willing to get scared every time somebody says something about a new terror threat or if the government says something. I mean, the chances of anyone being hurt in a terrorist attack are infinitesimal. And, you have much more likelihood of getting struck by lightning. And yet we have allowed our country to be transformed as a result of these more or less abstract threats. I mean, one of the best terrorism analysts I know, Brian Jenkins from RAND, told me that no one wants to admit it, but the decade since 9/11 is the safest in terms of terrorist attacks in the United States in 40 or 50 years.
Wow.
We had more terrorist attacks in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, you had the Weather Underground, you had the right wing groups.
Right. Then we've had since 9/11.
Abortion clinic bombing.
Right.
Doctors, remarkable. James Risen with us. His new book, Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past that. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and James Risen is with us, the New York Times Pulitzer Prize winning, New York Times bestselling, New York Times reporter, and author of Cost of War. What's the first one?
State of War.
State of War. Thank you. There we go. State of War, and now his new book, Pay Any Price. In Pay Any Price, you lay out some really, really shocking revelations. For example, we shipped pallets of cash to Iraq in a way that were actually visible from outer space on surveillance satellites. They could see pallets of cash being piled up on the ground outside these trucks or outside the planes that they were taken off of. What happened to that? It was billions of dollars.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. The Bush administration took truckloads and truckloads of currency, $100 bills and pallets, out of the East Rutherford, New Jersey currency facility of the Federal Reserve Bank in New York, trucked those to Andrews Air Force Base outside Washington, then flew on C-17s, flew the cash to Baghdad International Airport, and then convoys picked up the cash at Baghdad International Airport and took it down what was then called Route Irish to the Green Zone or to the Iraqi Central Bank. And from there, nobody knows what happened to a lot of it. And they airlifted between $12 and $14 billion in $100 bills, and in many flights over a period of about a year and a half.
And this is into a country where the average annual wage was in the neighborhood of $1,000 a person.
Yeah, yeah, it was remarkable. And then once the cash arrived, there was virtually no oversight, no accounting, and a lot of it was stolen or wasted. And what I found and reported in the book is that Stuart Bowen, the Special Inspector General for Iraq, was the only U.S. official who really cared what happened to the money. And he and his investigators tracked it to some of it, almost $2 billion, to a bunker in Lebanon, and it realized it was money. It had been stolen in Baghdad and then secretly transported and was being hidden in Lebanon.
Do we know where it is now?
Last time anybody knew, it was still in the bunker, but I'm not sure. It could have been moved.
Yeah, yeah. That's amazing. I mean, it's like we're awash. $2 billion is meaningless?
Right, yeah. And then Bowen tried to get the U.S. or the somebody to go do something about it. He found that like there was no interest whatsoever.
Yeah.
By the time he found out about it, which was in the Obama administration.
Yeah. Just a few minutes ago, we were talking about James Madison's warning that no country can survive, can retain its freedom in a state of perpetual war. We were talking about George Orwell before the break. How, in your mind, well, let me recalibrate that question. Barack Obama ran basically on a platform of, I'm going to undo the damage Bush has done to this country. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not going to torture people anymore. We're not going to call it the war on terror anymore. Things that more or less he followed through on, or appears to have followed through on, or says he's followed through. Okay, you don't think he's followed through on. Tell me about this. And where should we be going? What specifically could he be doing in the next 2 years to reduce the possibility of our loss of our freedoms, basically?
Well, I think he has, as I said before, I think he's made the war on terror permanent in direct contrast to what he said he was going to do. Mm-hmm. When he was running for office. And you could argue that the one thing that he has stopped is the use of torture, enhanced interrogation techniques. Although in the executive orders and the policies that he's laid down, he has not banned their use permanently. He's only said, we're not going to use it right now.
Hmm.
If you just look down the list of things that have happened or not happened, said he was going to close Guantanamo, and he didn't. He allowed Congress to shove him around on that issue. He didn't really stand up and make it a major issue. He just caved in. He's expanded the use of predator drones, and been given by his Justice Department lawyers new powers to kill without due process American citizens through the use of predators or airstrikes or even ground troops.
Hmm.
And he's continued, you know, the war in Iraq, which he claims credit for having ended, in fact, all he did was pull troops out by the deadline that Bush had negotiated. People don't, you know, Republicans in particular don't want to remember this because it's inconvenient politically. But right. George Bush, before he left office, negotiated a status of forces agreement with the Iraqi government that called for all of the U.S. troops to be pulled out of Iraq by, I think it was 2010, 2011. And all Obama did was abide by that. And so you can't credit Obama for doing anything differently on Iraq than Bush was planning to do. And so, and in fact, he actually increased, dramatically increased troop levels in Afghanistan for no apparent objective.
Is this, do you think, a case of how the office captures the person?
I think that's partly true, but I also think Obama was never as liberal as people thought, particularly on national security. I think one of the little precursors, in hindsight, one of the measures that you can judge, or people should have paid more attention to, was his vote in the summer of 2008, while he was still a senator, but he was running for president, on legislation on the NSA, in which it was the Bush administration was seeking new legislation to basically endorse the NSA warrantless wiretapping program and to give them bigger power. Obama voted for it and voted for immunity for telecommunications companies, legal immunity.
Yikes. Okay, we're talking with James Risen, New York Times bestselling author, reporter for the New York Times. His new book, Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. We'll be back with more of my questions and your questions for James Risen right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Once again, James Risen's new book, Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. Check it out. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. James Risen in the studio with us. We're very pleased and honored to have him with us. New York Times bestselling author, New York Times reporter, his new book, Pulitzer Prize winning reporter, his new book, Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. James, tell us about Dennis Montgomery.
Dennis Montgomery is really one of my favorite stories in the book. And he was a computer software expert who claimed that, among other things, he claimed he had a lot of different technologies that were kind of super secret. Mm-hmm. And one of them was claimed that he had the ability to detect hidden messages in videotape. And one of the things that he claimed he could do after a long process, long series of coincidences and connections that he made with the CIA, he convinced the CIA, or the CIA became convinced, depending on who you talk to, that that he could detect hidden numbers and letters in Al Jazeera news broadcasts, in the videotape of Al Jazeera broadcasts. And he claimed that in the banner on Al Jazeera, his technology would find these numbers and letters that were showing up.
There were secret messages to terrorists.
Yes, the CIA became convinced, and this is one of the more interesting aspects of this, is did he let them become convinced of this, or did he convince them, or did they just want to believe this, that these numbers and letters corresponded to international flights that Al-Qaeda wanted to attack, and that these were messages to their far-flung network of agents who were going to strike and attack these international flights around the world. Mm-hmm. And the CIA became convinced that this was in 2003. They became convinced, so convinced that they told President Bush. They had a super secret source that was warning them that all these international flights were going to be attacked. And so at Christmas 2003, President Bush ordered the grounding of all these flights around the world. based on Dennis Montgomery's technology.
So a lot of people had their holidays disrupted.
Yes. And I was told that there was even a discussion at the White House about shooting down some of these planes.
Whoa.
Based on the new authority that the Bush administration believed President Bush had to target airplanes in the air if they posed a terrorist threat. And after one of the some of the flights that were grounded were in France, and the French government and the French intelligence service didn't was not amused by this, and so they demanded to know from the CIA what source of information had they were using to base this grounding on. And finally, the CIA told them about this technology that they had were getting from Montgomery, and the French had a French high-tech firm check it out, and they realized that this was just a fabrication. And after it took a while for the CIA to become convinced that this was a hoax, but eventually once they decided this was a hoax, they covered the whole thing up and kept it secret. And Montgomery got even more contracts from other parts of the government after
that. He didn't go to jail for scamming the CIA?
No.
He took millions from them?
According to the CIA...
To watch Al Jazeera?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he got contracts from different arms of the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept getting more contracts later for up until the early days of the Obama administration.
That's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. Let's pick up a couple of calls, if that's okay with
sure.
you. Where did my cursor go? There it is. Bill in St. Helens, Oregon. You're on the air with James Risen. Bill?
Oh, Bill, I'm sorry.
Hey.
Yeah, Mr. Risen, I've been following this a little bit. I'm actually just reading an article about it in The Nation as we speak. I think you should turn this around on these people. It seems to me like the CIA and the Justice Department, they're way more concerned about protecting unconstitutional criminality than they are about upholding their oath to protect and defend the Constitution. I don't think any of these people have any right to any of these people that have supported these illegal acts have any constitutional authority to hold you accountable in any way, shape, or form. I would make that the thrust of every argument. Why aren't you protecting the Constitution? Why are you siding with the criminality? Because that's really what they're doing.
Thoughts?
Well, I mean, that's as I said earlier, my answer to the government is that I'm still writing. I keep writing. That's what my answer to the government is, this new book. I wanted to keep uncovering and investigating abuses of power. And so my answer really is just keep digging, keep after them, stay in their face, I guess.
Yeah. And talking about the Constitution,
yeah,
as it were.
Yeah.
I mean, that's. What you have a colleague who was over at Fox News who his name is Rosen,
right? Yeah,
who was also being looked into by the Bush administration,
or the Obama administration.
Yeah. In fact, Eric Holder just came out and said that I think this morning or yesterday that naming him and co-conspirator was the thing that he wished he could not undo.
Right.
Regretted.
Right.
Is he in the same boat as you? Is that?
I don't know the full details of his case. He hasn't spoken out publicly much in the past, so I don't know the details. Although I just know the way the Obama administration has dealt generally with the press and with whistleblowers is, as I've said many times, they're the greatest enemy of press freedom in a generation. They've cracked down on more, they've prosecuted more of these cases than all previous administrations combined, and they keep they seem determined to try to limit national security reporting to accepted pathways. They are trying to punish reporters and stories that don't conform to the White House's accepted messaging.
Storyline, as it were. Yeah, remarkable. Jim in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, listening to WCHL. Hey, Jim. You're on the air with James Risen.
Hey, Tom. Yes, I'm enjoying the conversation very much. I find it fascinating. I wanted to just backtrack for a minute and give you a sidebar story, which is true, of another example of cash being moved, and perhaps Mr. Risen may know something about this. But at 9/11, my wife and I were living in Miami, Florida, and my wife was a mid-level manager at Royal Caribbean Cruise Line. And that Saturday, a cruise was departing for 1 week to the Western Caribbean, and Lindsay said that approximately 100 members of the Bin Laden family showed up in all kinds of limousines and with absolutely hundreds of steamer trunks, not just suitcases, steamer trunks, and that they were allowed to circumvent the regular customs and Royal Caribbean check-in. They were led in by higher-ranking government officials to another part of the ship, and instead of making the entire sojourn, they conveniently got off with everything they had in the Cayman Islands 3 days later after sailing. And I would just like to believe in my own mind that there may have been a lot of cash there. And again, it had to have been orchestrated, this entire thing, by somebody very, very high up, because Royal Caribbean would not have allowed that under any other circumstances. So,
Jim, thanks for the call and thanks for the question.
I've never heard that story, but I do know it's been reported pretty widely that right after 9/11, a lot of Bin Laden family members were allowed to leave the United States by the Bush administration.
In fact, those were the only planes that were in the air.
I can't remember all the details. I just remember that it's been confirmed that the Bush administration allowed a bunch of Bin Laden family members to leave very hurriedly from the United States.
Right. That's a whole sidebar story.
Yeah.
Zachary in Bryan, Texas. You have a question for James Risen?
Yes, I have a question dealing with the money that he said earlier in the show that was trucked over to Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that our government, and the Iraqis, that they want that to go missing in order to fund the war indirectly, you know, to keep, like, funneling it to these terrorist groups, either giving it to them or allowing them to steal it?
We don't know who exactly stole it. I can't identify that. All I know is that the Special Inspector General for Iraq realized that that very powerful Iraqis working with some clearly powerful people in Lebanon managed to steal and then move this money to Lebanon for safekeeping for their own use. We don't know who they are exactly or what they're planning to do with it exactly. But I have no evidence of any U.S. Officials' involvement with the theft.
And on that, we'll be back in just a moment. We're talking with James Risen, New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning, New York Times best-selling reporter, writer, author, book writer, and his new book, which is absolutely brilliant. You need to get over to your favorite place to buy books and check this thing out. Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War by James Risen, R-I-S-E-N. Check it out.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of your questions in mind for James Risen. And welcome back. David in Ypsilanti, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. You know where Ypsilanti is, don't you?
I do. Indeed. Yeah. I used to live in Detroit.
Yeah. I used to live nearby. David, you're on the air with James Risen.
Hello. Yes. Hello. I don't want to sound like some conspiracy guy. I would like to know if you guys know who funded ISIS. Because I know the United States formed Al-Qaeda to fight at, you know, the Russians in Afghanistan. My whole family thinks I'm nuts because of this, but I mean, it's documented. You can watch Hillary Clinton, you know, addressing Congress about it. But who really formed it? Is it Saudi Arabia, or was it, you know, America? You know, who formed this ISIS group?
David, thank you for the call. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's a complicated answer. ISIS is really a symptom of the dysfunction and the chaos in Iraq that we left behind, or that we created with our U.S. with our invasion in 2003. What we did essentially was, when we invaded Iraq and overturned Saddam Hussein, we not only got rid of Saddam Hussein, but we essentially overturned the whole social society, the demographics of the society, because we said, okay, now it's got to be a democracy. And that meant that the majority Shia population would suddenly, for the first time in modern history, be in charge of Iraq. And the Sunnis, who had, Saddam Hussein had been a Sunni, were now a minority. And ever since our invasion, the central fight in Iraq has been between Sunnis and Shias. And the ISIS is an outgrowth of that continual civil war, sectarian war, going on between Sunnis and Shia. Sunni insurgent groups throughout the Middle East in recent years have been funded probably by wealthy Arabs in countries like Saudi Arabia or the Gulf or other places. And now ISIS has been so successful that they're generating a lot of their own money and capturing a lot of their own arms.
I'm curious what you think about Steve Clemens reporting in The Atlantic that John McCain and Lindsey Graham basically went to the Saudis and said, please fund these Sunni nationalists against al-Assad, and that became ISIS. It just ran out of
control. I don't know. I mean, I think that's probably a little overly simplistic. I think there's a number of groups, Sunni groups in Syria, who were trying to fight Assad, and that became kind of a proxy fight between Sunni Arab countries and Iran and the Shia and the Alawites are kind of aligned with the Shia,
right.
And so it's a very complex melting pot of what's happened in Syria. So I wouldn't say that ISIS is a direct result of that. I think what you had was a very messy, chaotic situation in Syria.
And a lot of the ISIS fighters, members, a lot of the leadership are ex-Iraqi military.
Yeah.
They basically kicked out of their jobs,
right,
by L. Paul Bremer, and they've been unemployed for 8-10 years, whatever it is. Anyhow, we'll be back with more of James Rice. Tom Hartman here with you. James Rison in the studio with us, taking your calls and talking about his new book, Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. And Rick in San Antonio, Florida. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Yes, Tom, thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I'm interested if either one of you have heard or have read of the Senate Intelligence Report, the pre-war intelligence to the lead up to the Iraq war. It's on the Senate.gov website. One easy way to find it is to Google phase2b.pdf to see the initial draft of the report. And there's also a response to this report. I'm interested if either one of you has read this report.
I have not.
I think if you're talking about the same thing that I think you're talking about, I think I wrote about it when it came out years ago.
What's the point of it, Rick?
The point of it is that there are some Bush officials, appointees, that appear to be directly involved in the activities that led up to the Iraq war, and I just wondered if you'd like to comment on that or not.
Yeah, okay. Rick, thank you. Apparently not.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what the question was.
Yeah, okay. I'm not either, so. Devon in Blacksburg, Virginia. You're on the air with James Rison.
Great. I'm looking forward to reading Pay Any Price. And I'm wondering if there's been any investigation into the alliance between the British company that Michael Chertoff is chairman of the board for, that's BAE Systems, who now helps sponsor the PBS NewsHour. BAE Systems and the U.S. Army cooperate at ammunition plants, at least three locations in the United States, where BAE is making a handsome profit while the U.S. Army picks up the cost of the environmental permitting and violations. I'm speaking specifically of the Radford Army ammunition plant, but there's also one in Kingston, Tennessee. BAE has a very ugly environmental record at these facilities.
Well, let's get James's thoughts on this. Devon, thank you for the call.
I don't know anything about it, but it sounds interesting. Maybe it's something I should look into.
There you go. Okay. Your spidey sense, your reporter sense
yeah.
goes. Kathy in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Kathy, thanks for listening to 92.1 FM. You're on the air with James Risen. Kathy? Kathy is listening to her radio, not her phone. Margie in Portland, Oregon. You're on the air with James Risen.
Yeah. Hello. Mr. Risen, it's great to be able to talk to you and listen to you. And, Tom, I always love you. I'm not sure, Mr. Risen, if you can answer this, but I would like your opinion on why you think the Obama administration has been as bad, if not worse, than the Bush administration about whistleblowers and journalists after all of his talk about how they had the right to report the truth and they were needed. And now it sounds like he's even prosecuting more of them.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's the $64 question in my mind about this administration, why this is happening. I think part of it is the advances in technology make it easier for the government to conduct investigations. Another part of it is just the kind of the growth of the national security state has made it more aggressive in pressuring the White House and pressuring the Justice Department to go after reporters and whistleblowers. But I also think that after, you know, this much time and this many prosecutions, it's what Obama wants to happen. I mean, a president sets a policy and a pattern of behavior and a tone. And so I think clearly if he didn't want this to happen, it wouldn't be happening. So I think there is something about the way he deals with the press that has led to this.
Well, and apropos of today's news, we've got, you know, Casey Hickox, this nurse who was in West Africa, who now Paul LePage is chasing around Maine. And it seems that some of these governors, Paul LePage and Chris Christie in particular, have discovered that selling fear works, and they're
right.
both up for reelection. And there's a few Democrats who are doing it, too. Could it just be that that's the gestalt of the day, that
yeah.
Bush reacted to 9/11 in a way that was like, oh, my God, we're afraid, we have to kick back,
right.
rather than saying, you know, when the Washington Post reported that the Taliban offered to turn bin Laden, arrest him and turn him over to a third country for prosecution if Bush would simply provide some evidence, he should have said yes, and
right.
we could have done this as a police action.
Right, right. Yeah, and then Obama has extended that war on terror, that whole mindset.
Right.
And I think his approach to whistleblowers and the press is part of his larger national security policy. It's part of this effort he's done to kind of normalize the war on terror.
But in a certain sense, if that notion of the gestalt of the day,
mm-hmm.
whether it's the cause, whether it was, you know, produced by George W. Bush or not,
right.
He's kind of boxed in, isn't he? I mean, if he pulls back the way that you and I would like to see him pull back, they're going to jump down his throat.
Yeah, well, I mean, that you saw that on Guantanamo right
yeah.
away, where he signed an executive order ordering Guantanamo to be closed. And then when there were criticisms in Congress against him, he caved. And so...
Well, he didn't have any choice, did he? Didn't Congress pass a law forbidding him from using money?
I think the question really is, what about leadership? What is he going to lead on national security or not? Is he going to give in to the fears that have developed over the last few years? And I think the record now shows that he's decided not to fight on national security issues.
Which is unfortunate. It's really time to say this is the land of the free and the home of the brave. Damn it, we're brave.
Right.
James Risen, his new book, Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, Endless War. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
It's an honor and a pleasure to talk. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, and vote! Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.